Happy May. Hope you've had a good week. Today, we're studying with a new rabbi, Rabbi Matt Green from Congregation Beth Elohim in Brooklyn, New York. He came to us by way of one of our listeners, Jake Cohen, who also happens to be a phenomenal chef. If you haven't yet picked up his cookbook called Jewish, a Cookbook, Reinvented Recipes from a Modern Mensch, you really must. It's a staple in my kitchen, and his book made it to the New York Times bestseller list. So if you want to be one of the cool kids, you got to pick one up. But I digress. Today, we're going to use this week's Parsha reading to do something we haven't really had an opportunity to do on the show yet, namely to get a sense of the Jewish institutional landscape through the lens of a rabbi. And I think you'll quickly see why Rabbi Matt is a great fit for our show. If you're anything like me, when you see news that the world is reopening and social activities are permissible again, you might feel a sense of conflict. I cannot wait to be at a house party again. I can't wait to sit at a bar with friends, and wowie, I cannot wait to go to a concert or be on a dance floor. And yet, at the same time, I don't feel ready at all. We've just had this insanely traumatic year, and it feels like we're all expected to just hop right to it again, as if nothing ever happened. Well, Rabbi Matt will help contextualize how different rituals from Torah can actually help us frame the work that must be done if we're all to keep our marbles, as well as the opportunity that we can allow ourselves if we reimagine what's possible in the coming weeks and months. This is an exciting episode for me because I get to have a candid conversation with someone I really respect, and it makes me eager to dive into the next few weeks of Torah with Rabbi Matt at my side. Our side. If you're as stoked as I am, you know what I'm going to ask. Rate and review wherever you get your podcasts. Support us with your hard-earned shekels at patreon.com/thestudy and tell a friend. I'm glad to be able to introduce you to someone new and exciting. On to the show. I am so excited to welcome Rabbi Matt Green from Congregation Beth Elohim in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, to the show. Thanks for joining, Rabbi.
My pleasure. Hi.
Rabbi Matt, you're going to be with us for the next few weeks. So today you're serving as both guest and co-host. So before we jump into today's Parsha, I'd love to just learn a little more about you and your journey to the rabbinate. At Beth Elohim, you're the director of Brooklyn Jews. Will you tell us a little bit about that initiative and organization?
Yeah, Brooklyn Jews is a community that I inherited. It was started in 2003, roughly, by another rabbi who eventually came to Beth Elohim as the senior rabbi. His name is Andy Bachman. And Brooklyn Jews has always been an alternative community for people who may not be finding their Jewish wisdom or ritual lives elsewhere. And so over the years, it's changed. It's been many different things. It moved from being that kind of grassroots community of people in the neighborhood to being a 20s, 30s group, which is what I inherited when I became rabbi, or really when I became the rabbinic intern at Beth Elohim, which I'll call CBE. Basically, for the last 6 years, I've run this initiative that has sought to provide new ritual experiences for Jews who are mostly not members of synagogues. So it ends up being a lot of people in their 20s and 30s. I hate thinking about it like that because I actually don't know how old you are, but I don't know that you would really want to go to a 20s, 30s event. But in the past few years, we've put together not only the usual holidays and Shabbat dinners and services, but also a lot of cultural events. I work with a number of artists to put on various programs exploring Jewishness and Jewish themes, primarily through art. So that's what Brooklyn Jews is.
Amazing. What kind of art?
Oh my God. So many things. I should be clear. I know nothing about art, although I've learned a little bit. I pretend, right? I mean, I know a little about Judaism and rabbinic texts, but I have this hunch that artists are creating meaningful Jewish work. And so over the past 3 years specifically, I've worked with small cohorts of 6 to 9 artists at a time, learning Jewish texts, exploring Jewish themes, and then helping them cultivate work for a Jewish public or even a non-Jewish broader public interested in consuming Jewish art. And so we're talking about like Jewish sculpture and photography, but also plays and film and even Jewish burlesque and these sorts of things that I feel like are where many people are finding meaning in their lives and may not otherwise find it in a synagogue context.
I imagine in Brooklyn, you're surrounded by lots of wild and crazy artists, so that's probably a good fit.
That is true. And I've pushed the boundaries of what I thought was acceptable in synagogues, but also so many times I thought I was going to lose my job because of some crazy thing an artist did, but then I didn't, which is a sign, I guess, that Beth Elohim is a fine place for me to be.
So you attended the Jewish Institute of Religion at Hebrew Union College, and while you were there, launched Grindr Shabbat. What was Grindr Shabbat?
I think I may have said this to you at some point. I feel like on my headstone, it's going to say creator of Grindr Shabbat, because this is the thing that everyone wants to know about. Admittedly, like Grindr Shabbat is on hiatus, although I'm really thinking about bringing it back this summer of all summers, and maybe we'll say something about that. But essentially, after my first year of rabbinical school in Jerusalem, I moved to New York City and I was single and I was talking to a lot of guys on Grindr and realized that many of them were Jews. And even if they weren't Jewish, they were curious about what some rabbinical student was doing on Grindr. And so I thought, you know, why not bring them all together for a Shabbat dinner? And so Hebrew Union College gave me a small micro grant to do that, to host small Shabbat dinners for people I met on Grindr. And over the course of that year, it was basically 2 years that I was putting on different events for people I met on Grindr. And it ended up being like 200 people that I didn't meet them all on Grindr, but many of them I did. And a community kind of developed around Shabbat dinners and davening and other holiday observances.
Wow, that's incredibly exciting. You were like a sneak attack in Grindr to get people into Shabbat.
Yeah, I don't know that Grindr was really thrilled about that. And actually, I always wanted to get Grindr on board so they could like give us some funding. And so if you're listening and you work for Grindr, maybe, you know, come find me and we can come up with something.
I have to tell you, I actually just this last week met and spent some time with the chief marketing executive for Grindr. So perhaps this is the perfect timing. The study has helped figure it out. You know, I've been really excited to be in conversation with you for many reasons, but one is that you're the youngest rabbi that I've had the pleasure of speaking with, especially on this show. And I feel like a lot of the work that you do is engaging, like you say, 20s and 30s millennials in Jewish practice and community. And you were once quoted saying, "I don't believe in throwing away our institutions, but rather teaching them how to engage with the younger generation and adapt to this environment." Do you mind talking for a moment about where you find the Jewish institution landscape and what it is that they may need to adapt to?
Yeah, I mean, I think, let's face it, we have a lot of institutions. And sometimes they look like synagogues, sometimes they look like federations or JCCs or other sorts of Jewish buildings and institutions that we're familiar with. But many of those institutions are freaking out because young Jews aren't intuitively finding their ways into their buildings, into their funding structures. And part of the reason why is that the models that have worked for prior generations of Jews just don't seem to have an appeal for many people in my generation. And I don't think this is rocket science. I think this is true of every generation. People, baby boomers, I'm sure also experienced this, and their parents before them, that Jewish institutions needed to change to suit those generations' needs. And in prior generations, people belong to synagogues, for instance, for all kinds of reasons that had nothing to do with religious necessity. Perhaps people felt an obligation to their ancestors. Perhaps people felt some kind of obligation to Zionism or perhaps to other ideological thrusts that they were working with. But the synagogues didn't really change a whole lot. People belonged in large part because they had outside reasons for belonging. And we ended up with a bunch of Jews who belonged to synagogues that they attended twice a year on the high holidays. So I see that not working for our generation of Jews because we are pretty committed to all sorts of things, whether it's social justice or culture or our friends or any other issue that's on our mind. And we don't want engagement, certainly engagement that costs a lot of money, to just be a twice a year kind of thing. But at the same time, our institutions mostly offer us something that's vaguely church-like, and we know we don't really want that either. So my sense is that if our institutions can evolve to be places where social justice and culture and all these things I've already named find full expression in some Jewish space, then it's not rocket science. I think people will come. And the last thing I'd say about it is that we have so many institutions that it would be a shame if all of them closed. We already see that many of them have been closing and will close, especially in the pandemic. But they are a resource. The buildings themselves, the infrastructure, the history, and it seems like instead of closing them and creating new institutions, it may be worthwhile to change the institutions that we have.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. I mean, I personally am not a member of a synagogue, but I do, like exactly like you're saying, I feel almost a responsibility that I should belong to a synagogue because it's the kind of Judaism that I was brought up with and have a lot of great memories of that institution. Like Road of Shalom in Bridgeport, Connecticut was a place that I grew up in, and we had a big community and I was bar mitzvahed there. And, you know, that was every Saturday. That's where we spent time, and those were the families that we were close with. And so when thinking about starting a family or thinking about the kind of Judaism that I want to lead, like a community is a big part of that. And it feels like it's going to take or is taking some imagination to figure out, all right, if not belonging to a synagogue, what is the kind of place that or community that I want to help, help or just be a part of, I guess. I don't know if I have anything to help, but.
Yeah, but I also just want to say you come by it honestly, because I'm not sure that our parents' generation knew what they wanted either when it came to building their institutions. I think whether it was that our parents were closer to the generation that came to America, maybe they came to America themselves, or perhaps because of their proximity to the Holocaust, right? Like prior generations of Jews intuitively did the things that that their parents were doing in ways that we probably won't. And if our institutions are kind of a mess or having an identity crisis, it's also true that Jews are having an identity crisis right now. We don't have the same ethnic attachments we once did. We don't primarily marry other Jews. We don't speak Yiddish. Many of us don't speak Hebrew, right? We don't eat exclusively Jewish foods. And yet, we don't necessarily find so much meaning in praying the way that our Christian friends and neighbors might. And so a religious institution doesn't necessarily cut it either. There's got to be something else, something that's not ethnic and not religious. And we have to kind of create it together. It's really scary to be in this position as a leader of this generation because I don't have answers. I'm playing around a lot, which is why I ended up with Jewish burlesque shows. And I think that ultimately it's got to be something that we come up with together as a generation.
And that sounds incredibly exciting. I literally get chills like thinking about the possibilities there, because I see both through the Shabbats that I was hosting and this show, you know, we've got listeners all over the world right now, and I'm really honored to have that platform. But also it's like people seem to be excited about this and seem to be excited about plugging into the roots of what all this is about and figuring out how to apply it. It's just a matter of where, and do they want to belong to a shul that has one rabbi? And the idea of reimagining what that might look like is really exciting. And I know when I look around me that I've got hundreds of people that are interested in that. And so where do you do it? How do we do it as the world starts to reopen and as things are changing rapidly and we can reimagine what kind of everything looks like?
The podcast is simply a new medium for a very ancient thing, certainly in your case or this case, because the Devar Torah or a sermon or what you think of what a rabbi does in a synagogue is just a way of conveying media. And the podcast is a new way of doing that. And I think that, let's face it, people like being Jewish. A lot of people like being Jewish. Most of the Jews I know love being Jewish. They just don't know how to be Jewish. And so I think engaging with our ancient texts and these ideas in this way is at least one part of how they can be Jewish. So I think that this, what you're doing and what we're building together, is exactly what we should be doing right now.
Amazing, amazing, amazing. This is very exciting. Since you are joining us for the month of May, that means you get the rabbinical responsibility of giving us the partial lowdown. This week, a double portion, Behar Bechukotai. Rabbi Matt, what have we got in store for us this week?
Well, for one thing, I just want to say, I'm really honored that you invited me. And I think that in general, these Torah portions are terrible. I don't know if I said that to you, but I think that, you know, it would have been great to be invited for Genesis. Okay. We've got the end of Leviticus today, and eventually we'll get into the first few parshiot of Numbers. But Behar Bechukotai is a double Torah portion. It's the last two parshiot of Leviticus. And in some ways, the real thrill is Behar here, the first half. Because Bechukotai, as I'll say in just a moment, is kind of a coda or an epilogue to the book of Leviticus. But Behar is really focused on one major theme, which is the idea of Shemitah, or a sabbatical year. And the idea of a sabbatical year is, just like some people have sabbaticals at work after 6 years of working, they take some time off. The Israelites are commanded at the beginning of Parshat Behar to work for 6 years and till their soil and sow their fields and prune their vineyards. But after 6 years, they're supposed to stop and leave a seventh year for the land to rest. And more specifically, they say that the Torah says that you, in that seventh year, can eat whatever the field produces, but you can't farm it. It can't be some kind of economic benefit to you. And we'll say a little bit more about that later. But after seven cycles of these seven sabbatical years, we get 49 years, and then a 50th year that the Parsha calls a Yovel, or the Jubilee year, which is kind of like a big, big, big sabbatical, where not only is the land supposed to lay fallow, but all slaves are supposed to be set free. As the text is talking about the Jubilee year, it says, "You shall proclaim freedom throughout the land for all of its inhabitants." And that line is very important for American Jews, I suppose, in particular, because it is the line that's on the Liberty Bell. And as we thought, or our forebears in this country thought about freedom, they looked to this Torah portion to give us an example for what that might look like. Because in this 50th year, all slaves were supposed to be set free. And the idea is, with all of the laws that we find in Behar, that society needs a reset, that society needs some opportunity to let debts be canceled and to let slaves be freed, so that nobody ends up completely subservient for their entire lives. And so too, the land needs rest. That might be the most obvious piece of all, that by not sowing, tilling, and pruning our fields, we're giving the earth a chance to breathe. And so we come up against this idea of seventh year, and then after seven cycles of seven, we get a 50th year. That should be familiar to us from seven and Shabbat, right? It's related that we work for 6 days and then rest on the seventh. And throughout this Parsha of Behar, we come back to that idea of rest. And we're no longer thinking about time, we're talking about the economy. But so too with Shabbat, this Torah portion essentially gives us various laws that invite us to think about not functioning in an economy. Like, what kind of worth might we have, or might people have, that is not economic? And then we get to Parshat Bechukotai, which is basically God saying, if you do what I want, you'll be blessed, and if you don't do what I want, you'll be cursed. When you get to Deuteronomy, you're going to hear a lot of this, because this is a classic thing the Torah loves to say. Interestingly, there are 10 verses of blessings and 30 verses of curses, so do with that what you will. But after detailing those blessings and curses in Parshat Bechukotai, the text ends by talking about dues to the temple. So maybe that gets us back to thinking about institutions, because even the biblical authors were aware that the temple cult needed somebody to pay for it, and that's how it ends the Torah portion.
Wow, and that's the end of Leviticus, and we're done.
That is. We say chazak, chazak, venit chazek, as I'm sure you've said already on this podcast.
We have yet to say, will you explain to our listeners what that is? We haven't done that.
Chazak, chazak, venit chazek means strong, strong, you will be strengthened, essentially. Be strong as you finish a book of the Torah. So we say it five times throughout the lectionary cycle, throughout reading the Torah throughout the year, and we'll say it just this Shabbat.
So this idea of this Jubilee, this 50th year, the seventh generation, it's such a beautiful thought. The Jubilee year, that's what Shemitah is? That's what's called Shemitah?
So the Torah portion details two different kinds of years. One is Shemitah, which is the sabbatical year. So it's the seventh year. But then Jubilee is after seven cycles of seven, you get this 50th year. And that's when all the slaves go free.
Got it. If thinking about it in a historical context, like, was this actual law during this time back in the day? Or was this kind of an idea that we should aspire to?
So many scholars are critical of this idea. They think perhaps it didn't happen because it's a utopian idea. The idea is that the economy resets every 50 years. But there is some evidence that in ancient documents about property ownership, for instance, they would count down from the Jubilee year. So they were aware of the Jubilee. It was perhaps a centerpiece of the economic life of ancient Israel, but it definitely did happen, and people did look forward to it and mark their own calendars by it, for sure.
There's just so many things that this makes me think about. Definitely in Native American cultures, the idea of the seventh generation, and I imagine that Native American cultures were not very in touch with what was happening within the Jewish calendar back in the day. So just that seems to be a rolling thought of looking ahead 7 years is really interesting to me. And then I spent a lot of time with Occupy Wall Street and the strike debt movement, and then what they had, which was the Rolling Jubilee, which was a movement to try and cut out student debt and all kinds of debt, which is still a movement that is happening and alive and really exciting. I guess it's probably worth mentioning that in the math of Shemitah and Jubilee, this is actually a Jubilee year, 2021, right?
So it will be soon. The end of 2021 it's not a Jubilee year, it's a Shemitah year. And, you know, there's some gray area between them, right? Because they have a lot in common. But Jubilee is really the moment when all debts are canceled, and certainly property debts and rent, that sort of thing that we're talking a lot about these days, that the Jubilee year is when all of that gets canceled. Shemitah is what we're entering into this coming Rosh Hashanah. 5782 is a Shemitah year, which has perhaps more resonance among observant farmers in Israel than it does anywhere else. I should mention that all of these laws are only applicable in the land of Israel. So that, you know, we can do whatever we want with them, right? We can still take meaning from them, and I think we should, and we'll talk about that. But in their context, they were only applicable in ancient Israel. So Jews living in Babylonia wouldn't have observed these laws.
Well, let's talk about that. When you think about applying Shemitah and Jubilee to today, like, what are the first things that hit you?
Well, the first thing is, I mean, just to speak for a moment about what you mentioned, that think about it. In September of this year, we're going to be entering a Shemitah year. And most of us wouldn't even notice that. But almost all of us would notice that this coming September, things are going to feel a little different than they did last September. Just for me, thinking about the high holidays, this year we're looking at some kind of in-person experience, whereas last year we were entirely virtual. And that's true not only in our ritual lives, but we are finding ourselves thinking about re-entry. And as we do that, there are all kinds of rituals we might consider based off of the Torah and the Torah's rituals of re-entry. That makes me think of a different Torah portion from a few weeks ago that maybe we'll say something about in a second. But I think the reality is that you could look at the last year and a half of this pandemic and think, well, That was our chance to rest. That was our reset moment. But the reality is that it was kind of just our opportunity to see all the problems in our own lives and in the world and the country and maybe also in the Jewish community. And now we got to do something about it. And yet, I don't know about you, but I'm exhausted. And I think that the Shemitah year, beginning in September, but hell, I'd start it tomorrow, is a time for us to really think about what to do with everything we've learned. How can we actually reset? Now that we've seen the fissures in society and the fissures in our lives, how can we actually do that? And I think part of the answer is to not work. I mean, some of us are going to have to work. Hopefully all of us will have the opportunity to work if we want that. But we need to take a step back and not focus on tilling and pruning and sowing. And I can imagine that, I know that the headlines are saying that, you know, this is our time to bring the economy back. But it may be a time for us to think about our lives in non-economic terms. We've been so aware of our lack economically over the last year. And in that mode, we're still thinking about our worth in economic terms. And I think we need the space to really draw back away from labor just to see the virtue of being alive or the value in being alive and fixing all the things that we have now realized are broken.
As many manage anxiety and fear the world will speed back up before they're ready, permission to go slow is important. This Mental Health Awareness Month, One Table has a special invitation for those who are struggling and for those who love them. Drawing on wisdom from the animal kingdom and from our ancient wellness practice, they invite you to take a pause, the Shabbat you need. See their new pause episode today at onetable.org/pause. When you were talking about the Torah portion, you mean Tazria Metzora, and on this show, we talked a lot about bioethics is kind of what we covered. But the kernel for that week was kind of how and when to separate and reintegrate people who have been in quarantine for a variety of reasons. And just this week in Los Angeles, it was announced we're moving to the yellow tier, I guess, which means bars and gyms are going to open and restaurants at 50% and all that. And it sounds actually really daunting, like you're saying. You know, there's one part of me that's really happy and excited that things are opening up. And of course, that COVID cases numbers are down. But also, I feel like I need a vacation after the last year before heading right back into the old way of life. And I really appreciate this idea, or at least a recognition from the Torah that you actually have to stop for a second and take a break. I mentioned Occupy Wall Street. Like, that was a big thing. The critique of Occupy was that people didn't have a solution, that if you went down to Zuccotti Park, it was just people that were angry. And all right, well, what is it that you want? And if you don't have something that you want, then get out of here. But what that moment was, which hilariously built something like the Rolling Jubilee from the Strike Debt Movement, was a moment of people taking a second and trying to understand what was wrong with the system itself. And from that, you know, I would argue, we talked about the 1%, Bernie Sanders ran on the 1%, that started a movement. Now we have AOC in the entire the Justice Democrat movement. And that time of taking a moment to stop and not think about work, but think about what is the system, how is it screwing us, I guess, was meaningful and productive, I would argue. As excited as I am to see my friends again and have a beer in a bar, I get worried about the idea of just returning to what was before and not actually taking a moment to think about rebuilding both society as a whole, economically, and like you're saying, within the Jewish world. Like, do I leave this moment and start my process of shul shopping? Or do I start to look around and realize, like, over the past year through this show, I've talked to lots of rabbis and I've built a community partially, and like, all right, what can we build together? Where do you see that work, I guess, specifically since you're a rabbi in the Jewish community? Like, what is your experience through this moment of starting to, this moment of reemergence, I guess?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that there are so many moments on the Jewish calendar or in the life of the Jews when we are asked to take a step back and just reflect. And we get that every week with Shabbat, right? We get this day that we can care about or not, take seriously or not, but it's a day that really beckons us to not do work, and it's work to not do work. And sometimes it's not intuitive for us to, what do you mean I can't turn on the lights or on the television or turn on my phone? That's probably not the way that many people listening observe Shabbat, but that is what we're invited to do in the service of building something else, right? Shabbat is about taking a step back to build ultimately, because without taking some time to rest, then we're going to be lost during the rest of our week. So that's one thing that I'm thinking about in response to what you're saying. And obviously, we need some kind of blueprint for doing this. I mean, you've asked about the Jewish community, and I have lots to say about sort of where we're headed and what we're doing next. But I think one of the best things about Judaism is ritual. A lot of religions or a lot of traditions are really focused on belief. Judaism has beliefs, but more than beliefs, we have rituals. Right, you could be a fully observant Jew, not believe in anything, but do all of the rituals and you're good, at least according to many rabbis. And I think that right now what we need is ritual. Right, we've got this re-entry happening, and it's a really ambiguous, amorphous kind of re-entry. People are doing things at different times. They're feeling ready to take off their mask at different times, ready to be in person, and even getting the vaccine at different times. And so there's not one day that we can celebrate as the victory against the pandemic day. And since that's true, I think that there need to be other kinds of rituals that we offer. I think that when it comes to Tazria Metzora, which you mentioned, and I guess we've been talking about a little bit, that parsha from a few weeks ago offers us all kinds of things we're not going to do. We're not going to kill a pigeon. Okay, we're not going to like pinch off its head. We're not going to splatter blood all over places and put it on our earlobe. But we might consider, in the way that the Metzorah, the person afflicted, shaved their head and bathed, right? And in some cases, washed all of their clothes or took stock of the things that they owned. We might do some kind of renovation project in our lives. We might get a makeover, even if it's not an extreme one. We might think about our appearance and like the fact that we haven't really bathed the same way over the past year and a half, or who knows what it is. But one piece of it is just taking stock of our bodies and thinking about what we really want to do, what we need and what we want to do with our bodies. So one piece of it is that. I also think that we can look to traditions that do exist in contemporary Jewish life that are not associated with the Metzorah from that Torah portion, but could be beneficial in this moment. Like, for instance, is there a bracha for getting the vaccine? Well, no, not really. But then again, there are a ton that you could repurpose for that. We've been saying Shehecheyanu, the blessing for the first time you do something, and also Birkat HaGomel, which is the blessing you say after you've passed through a potentially life-threatening circumstance. Maybe it's those things. Maybe it's also saying Asher Yatzar, which is the prayer that traditionally Jews say after they use the bathroom. It's also in the morning prayers. And the idea is thanking God for our bodies and our openings and closings and the fact that things work well, ultimately in the service of being grateful, because the Metzorah in Tazria Metzorah, that Parsha, the Metzorah is, again, the person afflicted. They offer a sacrifice. They give an offering, which ultimately is a statement of gratitude. And so some part of coming out of this thing for us will have to be gratitude for the fact that we're alive and that we have the opportunity to rebuild something. And there's so much that we lost and so much mourning that we also need to do. And from there, we can draw from, or on that subject, we can draw from various Jewish mourning rituals. But at the same time, we need to be grateful and have it all. We just need to acknowledge how much is conflicted in this moment. And I think rituals can be a way of expressing those things. Even if we don't know how to say what we're feeling in this bizarre moment, we can do things that help express something subconscious within us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so moved by everything that you're saying, and just the idea of pausing to recognize what we've been through, right? Like, society, at least American society, doesn't have a space for that. Like, we are expected, like you're saying, to jump back in and restart the economy and get back out there and go get a margarita with your friends. And like, the idea of having a Shabbat right now with my friends is really exciting. Like, an in-person, even outdoor, all vaccinated, having a Shabbat with friends is really exciting. I haven't done it yet. I'm excited to soon. But the idea of actually saying Birchat HaGomel and looking around and realizing that the people that I love and have built something with are alive after what we've just been through is really overwhelming and powerful. And it would be so sad not to take the moment to do that. And the fact that there are these rituals built into Judaism that allow and kind of demand that recognition is something I'm really grateful for and want to continue to remember to do. Even like morning prayers, which again, like, I'm still finding my own relationship to prayer itself, but starting the day with Mode Ani and taking the moment to say I'm grateful for being alive and having the power to be compassionate is just a great ritual and practice. And something that when I remember to do, does change my day. It's really nice to remember that there are some things and rituals built into what we've got going here that can be really helpful for this reemergence. And I don't know what that means exactly for the idea of like, okay, let's focus on not working, because I know I need to work, but also all these things are so nuanced and so complicated, and that we have to hold both, right? Like, yes, we have to work and we have to pay rent and all these things. And also at the same time, we can try and remember that we need to take a moment to take a step back. Or maybe this is a time where Shabbat is extra important, right? If we can't take an entire year off of thinking about the about how to pay rent, we can really make the most out of Shabbat and really make the most out of taking these times to pause. And that's something that sounds helpful, at least to me in my life.
Well, importantly with Shabbat, I mean, Shabbat isn't saying don't work ever. It's saying don't work on the seventh day, meaning work really, really hard for 6 days. But then after you give your all, have a moment for yourself and maybe for God and for your family or whatever else it is that is meaningful to you. But I think also, you know, we've been talking about rituals and the need of rituals, need for rituals. Something I say frequently is that rituals are a conscious expression of the self, which is to say that there's a whole lot of weird stuff swirling inside of us at any time. And sometimes we don't know how to articulate those things. But by doing something, we're able to express something we actually otherwise don't know how to say. And so maybe that is waking up in the morning and saying Mode Ani, as you just mentioned, because there is a belief that we feel that it's good to feel grateful, but maybe if we don't do that thing, it'll be hard to express how grateful we feel that we are simply able to live. And so too with Shabbat, we're doing this thing. We don't necessarily know what it means, but there is some deep need within us that must be expressed, which is the need to rest. And so we give ourselves the ritual space to do that with Shabbat. I think the point is that Shemitah here for us is a chance to do something that we might not be inclined to do otherwise. We are so inclined to go drink with our friends and have big parties and, of course, experience all of the FOMO that entails. But we can't go too quickly. Shemitah might not look like really quitting your job and going to work on a farm, or if you're working on a farm, going to spend time in the city. Sorry, don't want to assume we're talking to Jews, but so be it. Right? It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to quit your job, but it does mean doing things, marking time, marking even space, such that we're able to see that this world is not normal, that a reset is necessary. And whether we're talking about racial justice or economic justice, or we're talking about our relationships with our parents or our friends or our partners or our employers, we need a reset. And unless we think about it that way, we'll just go back to business as usual. But the world is not the world as it was. And so having just a frame, let's say, more than quitting your job or taking a month off or something, although those things can be good, just having a frame of acknowledging that in a couple months, once the world goes back to normal, supposedly, we are not. And so we need to look at things and relationships and conversations and choices differently.
So with all of that in mind, you are a rabbi, you work with a congregation. I imagine you can't actually take time off, and Shabbat is a time where you are actually working. So what does that mean to you? What does that look like in your process and in your experience of being able to take a step back and take stock?
Well, for one thing, many rabbis do take sabbaticals. I don't think that, certainly I'm not going to take a sabbatical, and I don't think many rabbis are going to be able to take sabbaticals just because we want to after this pandemic. But the reality is that for many of us, and I talk to so many rabbis, and we all feel similarly, the well is dry, which is to say that, of course, we know things and we are able to perform, but being a rabbi is itself a creative pursuit. And unless you give yourself the space to read and think and be as a Jew and as a human being, you're not going to have much to offer in the next phase of whatever you're doing. I think for us, we're looking ahead at in-person High Holidays, and I'll speak personally. I'm thinking about what that's going to look like. It's so joyous, but I know that unless I take some time, let's say this summer, maybe a week here or there, or if I go offline, truly offline, not looking at my inbox or my texts or anything for some period of time, unless I do that, I'm not going to be able to have the High Holidays that I want to have, and I'm not going to be able to serve people. And I want to be clear that I certainly don't think rabbis are the ones who are exclusively creating Judaism for the people. But given that rabbis are the designated ritual leaders these days of the broader Jewish community, I think not only I, but so many rabbis need to find some way of filling up that well. And maybe it's just taking some time off and it can be as simple as that. But the other thing I'd throw into the mix is that our version of Shemitah, whatever frame we're giving ourselves to think about how we live after this pandemic, should probably include some awareness that we don't have to produce all the time, that our value is not based in how many people are joining the synagogue or how many people like a tweet or whatever it is, or I don't even know what happens on Twitter, actually. But point is that it's not based in the economic things that we maybe once thought it was. Because there, especially in a moment when the Jewish community is confused about itself, rabbis have even more pressure to put on themselves, and from external pressures, I suppose, to have the answers when the answers are pretty elusive. And so we've just got to give ourselves the space and the time to kind of just be and be okay.
Rabbi Matt Green from CBE in Park Slope, New York. I am so honored and grateful to have you here on the show with us, not only for today, but for the whole month of May. And if I had my druthers beyond, we'll figure that out later. I am really honored to be in conversation with you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's such an honor. And Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom to all of our listeners. We will see you next week. The Study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host and guest today was Rabbi Matt Green. Artwork by Julia Pott. We'll see you next week. How you live, how you fly, smiles you'll give and tears you'll cry. All you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be. Run! Rabbit, run! Dig that hole!